From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. After a tumultuous 18-month reign, distinguished by layoffs, celebrity hires, and skyrocketing ratings of his cable news competitor, CNN chairman Walter Isaacson announced this week he will leave the network in the spring to head the Washington-based Aspen Institute. He joins me now. Walter, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you so much. It's good to be back.
When we spoke to you last, about a year and a half ago, shortly after you had joined CNN, you were talking about finding a way to present real news and real policy issues in a way that was engaging to the viewers. And you pointed, this was in the thick of the wall-to-wall Chandra Levy coverage, which you were, in my recollection, a little defensive about. But you went on to talk about, for example, the Aaron Brown program and the Jeff Greenfield program as a way to be engaging and smart on fairly complex issues. Well, Aaron Brown is not getting a huge audience, and Jeff Greenfield's show is gone.
The Aaron Brown show is the most serious, quirky, smart newscast around today. It's successful. It doesn't beat Bill O'Reilly in the ratings, but it gets very good advertising and does very well. I'm sorry we did not succeed with the Jeff Greenfield show. It's hard to do a half-hour, 11 p.m. show and make it successful on cable. I just wanted to avoid having that, the type of anchors that are there to shout at you in the CNN mix.
This is not quite an exit interview because you still have, in all probability, a war to keep track of over the next few months. But as you leave CNN, or as you prepare to leave CNN, what went right during the Isaacson regime?
There were two main things we tried to do in the past couple of years. The first was to keep CNN based more on reporting, real reporting and journalism, rather than the somewhat noisy opinion-type shows that you also find on cable. Secondly, we wanted to take CNN from being a rolling news network to something that had real programs.
All right, that's what you did right. What did you screw up to a fairly well?
Well, you know, it's always hard to square the circle for me between the best possible ratings, which generally could be putting on a car chase, versus what I consider the best journalism. And you try to square that circle, and sometimes you don't do it all that well. You don't get the mix exactly right. And we let everybody else define the terms of the battle, which is who got the best ratings last night. And I think that's not exactly the terms of the battle you want to have in journalism. We win if we're the most responsible, respected name in journalism and keep having a nice growing audience that attracts good advertisers, but we don't scramble and do everything possible for ratings.
The Sniper case, which was a classic example of cable news overkill, was that, in effect, a car chase?
Those of you who sort of report on the media or immerse yourself in it may watch hours on end of a news channel, but we have to remember most of our viewers are coming in and out, so it doesn't, you can't be off of a main topic because people are coming in to see what's really happening. I guess I'm getting a little defensive like I was a long time ago when we first talked. On balance, we probably should have fewer talking heads speculating. But in terms of the reporting in the news, I think it was a very valid story to report about.
If all car chases all the time is the sure path to a big audience, can you guarantee that CNN of the future won't be all car chases all the time?
You're right. If we wanted to get really good ratings, you wouldn't put Sheila McVicker in the Middle East doing investigative reports like she's doing. You'd do all car chases all the time. But I think you can destroy the soul of a news organization if you're doing car chases instead of having people reporting from around the world. So we're going to continue to do that, and I think it works because I think quality journalism, even if it doesn't get the best possible ratings, it does present that information environment that I think a lot of viewers and a lot of advertisers want.
Well, Walter Isaacson, thank you very much, and best of luck to you.
Well, thank you so much. It's good talking to you.
For the next few months, anyway, Walter Isaacson is the chairman of CNN, and he will be moving on to head the Aspen Institute in the spring.
FCC Chairman Michael Powell did not want a public hearing on the rules for media ownership, slated for review by the commission this spring, but it looks like he's getting one anyway. As the January 2nd deadline approached for filing public comments on the issue, opposition to further relaxation of the rules heated up across the media landscape, not just among consumer groups, but also entertainment companies, advertisers, and the creative community. It left Chairman Powell with a big, fat PR problem this week as he backpedaled a little from his pro-market stance during a Senate committee hearing on Tuesday and defended himself at a forum at Columbia Law School in New York City on Thursday.
I read a lot of headlines about what we're doing. I have strained to read one that's accurate yet. But I'll tell you this, there are going to be rules when this proceeding is over. We're debating about which ones and in what form and how they will be defended or justified. That's the exercise. But there are going to be rules when this is done.
We decided to hear this week from the creative community, specifically Jonathan Rintels, executive director for the Center for the Creative Community. He says that deregulation can squeeze out diversity, that when the FCC threw out rules a few years ago that guaranteed independent producers access to the networks, originality took a big hit.
Up until about 10 years ago, the networks could not produce the programming that they aired on their schedules. They could only distribute it. But the rule change allowed the networks into the business. They promised that they would always use and need independent producers. But instead, what happened was they have increasingly monopolized the production of programming on their schedules to the point where NBC now owns a financial interest in 100% of the new series that they're airing in the current season.
There are some who say that entertainment programming is as creative and as original as it's ever been.
You know, I think television in a lot of ways is terrific, but if you look at the shows that are the most creative, push the envelope the most, a lot of those are holdovers from the prior years. You might want to take a look at the deal that NBC recently did to renew Friends, which is a show that they don't own, which is a holdover from the years when independents could get on the air, $10 million for a half-hour episode. Well, why did they feel that they had to do that? The reason is they haven't developed themselves any new hit comedies in the last 5 years to take the place of Friends.
And that's just about the same time as when the rules changed.
Yes.
So you're talking about rules that were relaxed years ago that allow the networks to do more of their own production in-house. But how does the relaxation of the media ownership rules affect your concerns?
For example, ABC a few years ago was just a broadcast network. They didn't have a production arm. So they couldn't produce much of their own programming. But then Disney bought them. Disney did have a production company. And the corporate edict went out that Disney would produce all of the programming that would run on the ABC network. And it put ABC at the absolute bottom of the ratings.
And you would say that's directly related to their producing in-house and the media consolidation.
Yes, absolutely. For example, the dual network rule, what that rule prevents at the moment is any of the top four networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox, from combining. So if you suddenly have four major networks turn into three major networks, you have a huge loss of one point of view that covers the entire country and the potential for mischievous rerunning of shows on network-owned cable stations, or in the case of CBS, they've rerun shows on UPN.
Right. Now, the FCC predicted the reverse, that they would diversify their programming.
The FCC said, well, if Viacom, which owns CBS and UPN, owns these two networks, they'll aim one at one audience and one at another audience. Well, instead, they have taken the same show, run it on CBS, and then a few days later, run it on UPN.
But don't big networks have the right to save money?
Well, of course they have the right to save money, but do they really have the right to buy up all the various networks and turn them into VCRs in case you didn't see it the first time or didn't want to watch it the first time.
But can you prove, can any constituency against the relaxation of these rules prove that any real harm has been done to the diversity of voices, to American values, to American culture, to any of the things that are always invoked in this argument?
Well, it's very hard to do an academic study. The FCC has proved that itself by doing its own studies that have really been criticized for being sloppy and not addressing the problem. But what you can point to is simply the walking away by the American public from the broadcast networks, that their share of the television audience has plummeted over the last year. And the reduction in the sales of American programming overseas to foreign markets. And while we would not say that the sole reason for that is that network-produced programming is less interesting, we think it's one of the reasons.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Rintels is Executive Director of the Center for the Creative Community.
And now an update. Last winter, we spoke with Stanford Law Professor Lawrence Lessig about the controversy around the Sonny Bono Copyright Protection Act, or, as he referred to it, the Mickey Mouse Protection Act. Whatever you call it, the bill passed by Congress in 1998 extended copyright protection by 20 years. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Bono Act, ruling 7-2 that the act was perfectly constitutional and did not infringe upon freedom of speech. Free speech advocates and internet publishers are grumbling, but the big media companies that lobbied for the law, like AOL, Time Warner, and Disney, can rest secure in the knowledge that The Wizard of Oz and Mickey Mouse are protected for an extra 20 years.
Now it's time to say goodbye to all our company. M-I-C.
C. Senate Bill 505. Public Law 348-298.
K-E-Y.
Why? Because we'll sue you.
M-O-U-S-E.
Coming up, Al Jazeera speaks English, the New York Times talks ethics, and Lawrence Tribe prepares for the Supreme Court by trying out his argument on Brooke.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. With its around-the-clock coverage of the U.S. war in Afghanistan and its airing of recorded messages from Osama bin Laden, the satellite TV channel Al Jazeera became a household name throughout America. But while a satellite dish is all you need to watch the station in your very own living room, a working knowledge of Arabic is still needed to understand most of what's being said. Soon, that will change. At the network's headquarters in Qatar, plans are underway to start broadcasting an all-English channel by early next year. And for non-Arabic speakers who can't wait that long, Al Jazeera will be launching an English-language website within the next couple of months. Joanne Tucker is the managing editor of the new website, and she joins us now from her office in Doha. Ms. Tucker, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
Al Jazeera is being tuned in on many thousands of televisions in the United States, but I'm sure lots of Westerners who don't speak Arabic would just love to have translation of what is being broadcast on Al Jazeera, but that's not what you're offering, is it?
No, we're not offering a direct translation. What we're going to do is offer the same information, but really, you know, originally packaged and written or reported for a Western audience.
Is there something lacking in the coverage of the Arab and Muslim worlds that Al Jazeera recognizes that's behind this project?
Yes, there's quite a lot lacking. Television news in particular only sees the Middle East through the prism of kind of war, suicide bombings, conflict, weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, misery. But this is where we can be fairer, I think. By being a website, we can afford to do more news features. We can afford to give a more in-depth look. We can afford to give the news from a more human angle.
Al Jazeera became a phenomenon because it was a truly independent voice in an Arab and Muslim media world, which has been historically dominated by state-run media. Mm-hmm. Now, if that is its raison d'etre, if that is, as they say in advertising, its unique selling proposition, does it translate to the West, where there is a tradition of open and independent media? Do we need an Al Jazeera website in a media world that is not rigidly suppressed by Western governments?
Actually, there is a need. There is a very big need, because you're absolutely right. On the surface and in reality, you know, the Western press is free. But lately, especially after September 11th, lots of countries in the West, you know, have been fed this daily dose of terrorism, and, you know, who is a patriot and who is not, that in a way you don't have to be told to shut up, you just instinctively do. We think that there are very important questions not being asked or answered. Things like, who is a terrorist and who classifies who is a terrorist?
It sounds to me that in addition to providing the kind of context of life in the Arab and Muslim worlds, it sounds almost as if you're taking on a PR function, and forgive me, a propaganda function, to portray the Arab and Muslim worlds in a more flattering light. Is there a propaganda or PR function to what you're up to?
No, there isn't. You know, whether the West liked it or not, there are two or more sides to the war against terror. And I think as long as you very fairly represent each side in their own voice and according to their own words and their own experience of reality, then the truth comes out, the facts reveal themselves. You only are a PR and propaganda channel when you focus on one side of the story. We don't intend to do that.
Let me go to the demand side of the equation. Will it be difficult for you to earn the trust of Western readers, considering the provenance of your reporting?
I think that's a good question. I think it will be difficult simply because we are so notorious now in the West post-September 11th because of our exclusive coverage in Afghanistan.
And the airing of Osama bin Laden tirades and so forth.
Yes, but I think anybody would have done exactly the same thing. I think we're stereotyped, and I think this is because people who do not watch us or because they don't understand Arabic think we are very, very one-sided. We hope that we will prove this stereotype wrong, because if we were going to be very one-sided, or if we were going to be a pure propaganda tool, I don't think we'd last very long, and I don't think we'd be very popular.
Well, Joanne Tucker, thank you very much. All best of luck to you.
Thank you, Bob. It was a pleasure.
Joanne Tucker is the managing editor of Al Jazeera's new English language website, scheduled for launch in the next couple of months.
This week, the New York Times unveiled its new expanded ethics policy, all 53 pages of it. Under the new policy, for example, reporters are barred from having a financial interest in any entity they cover, and columnists, op-ed writers, and editors on the masthead are barred from owning any stock except the New York Times. Political expression is verboten. No contributing to campaigns. No displays by journalists or their families of political bumper stickers, campaign buttons, or lawn signs, and many more do's and mostly don'ts. Bob Steele of the Poynter Institute dedicated his column this week to the revised New York Times Ethics Code, applauding its rigor, clarity, and detail. And he joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
So what do you think about the code? It's certainly comprehensive.
And it's realistic. Those that created this document clearly state in there in several ways that this isn't the end-all, be-it-all. For employees at the New York Times, there will be issues that come up that they'll have to parse and peel. But the tone of the code serves the purpose of clear standards and good decision-making process.
It has been criticized as rather draconian in places. The rules on stock ownership, for example. Under the old policy, only some business section employees were barred from owning stock in companies on which they directly reported. Under the revised policy, all staff members are barred from having a financial interest in an entity that they cover regularly as a reporter or an editor. But can't full disclosure anticipate any accusations of conflict of interest?
Well, disclosure alone does not mitigate wrongdoing, nor does disclosure eliminate problems when they exist. So merely saying we've got a difficult connection, competing loyalty, conflict of interest does not make it go away.
Fair enough. But the part of the policy that particularly concerns me as a journalist is the one that seems to bar all participation in the political process. The rule stipulates that a staffer could be reassigned to avoid conflicts if a family member or a spouse is engaged in a political activity or partisan action. It strikes me that they're calling for a journalist to abrogate part of their responsibility as a citizen in order to avoid an appearance of conflict of interest.
Well, I don't know anything that says journalists must actively participate or citizens must actively participate in the political life of this country. We should, I do believe, vote in order to carry out our civic duty in a democracy. And the Times not only doesn't prohibit that, but I believe encourages that. A key point here, Brooke, that journalists regularly tell stories about other professionals and other organizations in our society where conflict of interest erodes their professionalism and can harm the public good. It is disingenuous, in fact, outright hypocritical for journalists then to say that conflicts of interest are not that big a deal in our profession. If we're shining the light of scrutiny on others, from physicians to lawmakers to government officials, we should be shining the light of scrutiny on ourselves and holding ourselves to exceptionally high standards.
Okay. Bob, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Bob Steele is director of the ethics program at the Poynter Institute. In November 2000, the online magazine Slate polled its writers on how they voted in the presidential election. The results were overwhelmingly pro-Gore. Michael Kinsley, then editor-in-chief of Slate, wrote a column titled, "Most of Us Voted Democratic. Does that prove we're biased?" Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brooke.
So does that prove you're biased?
This is something people really don't understand. There is a fundamental difference between having an opinion and being biased. Any intelligent person, it seems to me, ought to develop an opinion. I'd be very suspicious of anyone who claimed not to have an opinion, and I'd even be more suspicious of someone who actually didn't have one.
So what were you trying to achieve with the poll of Slate writers?
Well, we figured that since people inevitably have opinions and we couldn't do anything about that, the best thing we could do would be to let the reader know what their opinions were so that they could factor that into judging what we write.
We were speaking with Bob Steele from the Poynter Institute, and he says that mere disclosure doesn't solve the problem.
I think disclosure is sometimes not enough. I think that, for example, financial reporters, it's not really enough simply to disclose their stock holdings. There really should be substantive rules that say don't invest in companies in the area you're reporting.
What about the rules against participation in political expression?
There's a history to that, I believe. It's the Linda Greenhouse rule.
Mm-hmm.
Linda Greenhouse is their very highly regarded Supreme Court correspondent, and she wanted to go to, or actually did go to, a pro-choice rally. And that's what led to this rule, I believe, after various iterations. It's a very odd theory that journalists should keep things under wraps, should keep them a secret as a service to their newspaper, because journalism is about not keeping things secret, but about reporting things and a belief that sunlight is the best disinfectant. So you have to be suspicious of the argument that you should not reveal things in order to increase your credibility.
Do you think that journalism in general is broken? Do you think it needs to be fixed or cured by prescriptions like the Times Code of Ethics?
I do think that the Times, under its new editor, Howell Raines, has become a bit looser in defining what is a straightforward news story and is slightly more liberal overall if you had to assess its balance. And the New York Times seems to be deciding to give itself a bit more leeway about presenting things which imply or explicitly state an opinion. I don't think that's anything so terrible. And it's analogous to Slate's open acknowledgement of the voting of its various writers. And I would urge the Times to go more toward disclosure and less towards rules that are the opposite of disclosure, actually covering up people's views without them from having them as a way of accommodating this new freedom they're giving themselves, which I think is a basically very good thing.
The New York Times sets the standards for newspapers across the country. Do you expect that this code of ethics will be picked up in other places?
The New York Times is the best newspaper in America. It might influence other newspapers in two ways. One is through this code of ethics, and the other is through its model of giving its reporters a little bit more leeway in expressing the opinions that its rules say they're not allowed to have. I hope they adopt the second and not the first.
Michael Kinsley, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Michael Kinsley is the former editor and the founder of Slate.com.
Several years ago, activists condemned Nike in the press for unfair labor practices overseas and convinced many people to boycott Nike products. When Nike's critics made their charges, accurate or not, they were and are protected by the First Amendment. Nike responded. In public statements, letters to the editor, press releases, and newspaper ads, the company defended the treatment of people working in overseas factories where it had contracts. Then San Francisco activist Mark Caskey brought suit against Nike, charging that its statements on its labor practices amounted to false advertising.
Now, commercial speech in the form of advertising does not enjoy full First Amendment protection. It's regulated to protect consumers from fraud in ways that would be unacceptable for, say, political speech. Nike says that its statements about labor practices were not ads, and so were fully protected. But the California Supreme Court decided that corporations can be held liable for misleading statements, even those made in error, because they might boost sales. And now the U.S. Supreme Court has announced that it will hear arguments in the Nike case. Should Nike enjoy the same protection as its critics? When a company issues a press release, even if it never mentions its products, it still hopes to encourage people to buy them. Is that commercial speech or not? Harvard University Law Professor Lawrence Tribe says no. He's representing Nike in its quest to overturn the California Supreme Court decision, and he joins me on the phone from his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now, I'm a big fan of your work, but I don't think I'm with you on this one, so see if you can convince me.
I'll certainly try.
If Nike wins and the ruling is overturned, and it and other big corporations are given full First Amendment protection for speech that is ostensibly non-commercial, isn't this giving them greater latitude to lie or at least obfuscate?
The reason that companies all around the world are worried about the chilling effect of that rule isn't that they want a license to lie. It's rather that they realize that the only way they can survive under a rule of that kind is to clam up completely.
Or to be absolutely accurate in their statements.
There's no way anyone can guarantee absolute and total accuracy 100% of the time. That's why the U.S. Supreme Court, in case after case, has said that error must be protected if the freedom of expression is to have any breathing space. But there are plenty of protections against deception. I mean, people who are deceived by a company can sue for whatever injury that deception causes. The Federal Trade Commission can go after false advertising. And a company has a lot to lose and not a lot to gain in the course of debate by putting out phony statements about conditions at its factories when you guys in the media are able to engage in investigative reporting and show that they're in some way making a misleading statement.
I wonder, would the California ruling really give activists an unfair advantage? I mean, corporations have a lot more muscle to control public debate than the public interest groups that usually raise issues like these. Mr. Kasky was a consumer advocate. It strikes me that, if anything, this ruling levels the playing field a little bit.
Well, look, as somebody who is myself not generally sympathetic with the position that huge corporations take in their labor management relations, and who wouldn't mind seeing the playing field leveled, I have to tell you that I think that the way it'll be leveled is through a massive silencing effect. I mean, Nike, for example, decided, and I think had to decide, that it was simply not going to release anywhere in the world its next annual corporate responsibility report. Couldn't afford to, because it could be subjected to any number of Kasky-like lawsuits, which would be crippling. So the net effect, and I think the reason the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN filed amicus briefs on Nike's side was that they realized the net effect would be that journalists would find their sources drying up when they tried to find out stuff from these companies. It seems to me that the way our system works is we have debate about those matters.
But I refer back to that current extremely unlevel playing field.
We're not talking here about the power a state might have to deal with provably deliberate falsehood. We're talking about strict liability without any proof of any deliberate wrongdoing, deliberate lying, even negligence. And that, I think, is an important difference. But I appreciate the broader point you're making. In our society, the playing field is not level in a lot of different ways. But I think taking the maldistribution of wealth and power into account is a tricky thing if what you're doing is taking it into account by giving government officials the power to say what's true and what isn't true. I think there can be a vigorous debate about whether the net impact of globalization is positive or negative on people in the third world. But I wouldn't want anyone to claim to have the power on your behalf or on my behalf to give the final answer as to what, you know, what is the truth of the matter on issues of that kind, where fact and opinion inevitably blend. That's very different from selling a pair of shoes. I mean, if somebody says, here's a pair of sneakers, and, you know, they're made of the following ingredients, I expect not to be deceived. But if somebody says the people who made these sneakers were fairly treated and says that in a letter to the editor or in an on-air interview, the idea that that can trigger what amounts to a kind of inquisition in a California court in a lawsuit by any of 34 million citizens really does frighten me.
Well, thanks very much.
Okay. I don't know if I've persuaded you.
I'm a little closer now. Lawrence Tribe will make the oral argument on behalf of Nike before the Supreme Court on April 23rd.
Coming up, the birth of public relations and commercials that hide in the evening news.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with a few of your letters. Last week we spoke with Al Franken and Alan Colmes about a liberal answer to Rush Limbaugh and other strong conservative voices in the media.
Paul Murray from Pocatello, Idaho wrote, "Someone should tell these guys that the people will listen to them when they climb off their high horses. Doesn't Franken appreciate the absurdity of his posturing as too pure to do a show like Limbaugh's, even as he's stereotyping conservatives as simplistic black and white thinkers and the president of the United States as a liar?"
And Douglas Nelson from Dahlgren, Virginia, took it a step further. He wrote, "What I heard was worse than I expected. The producers of this show are openly and self-consciously attempting to indoctrinate America as to the philosophy of the Democratic Party." Douglas goes on to say, "I could not believe what I was hearing."
Probably won't be for the last time, so keep conveying that disbelief to us at onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Considering the power and subtlety of public relations today, it's hard to believe there was once a time when advertising was exclusively a blunt instrument, easy to spot and to duck. But in the early 20th century, as more and more products and people clamored for attention, one keen observer of human nature realized that the best pitches were the ones you couldn't see coming. What follows is the story of that self-proclaimed father of public relations.
In 1917, Enrico Caruso was coming to America. It was a multi-city tour, and his sponsors were molto apprehensive. The great tenor was demanding and capricious and not likely to win the hearts of the heartland, so Caruso's backers turned to America's consummate salesman, 25-year-old Edward L. Bernays. Bernays, fresh from 3 years promoting the Ballet Russe, paved Caruso's way with press releases extolling the man with the orchid-lined voice. He soothed and petted the transcendent tenor through Toledo, Pittsburgh, and Cincinnati, while regaling editors with tales that made Caruso an American hero before he sang a note. Bernays understood that shaping America's taste was not so hard once you had the key, and he knew the master locksmith. Bernays' mother was Sigmund Freud's sister. His father was brother to Freud's wife. Thus, young Edward was Freud's double nephew. And despite the doctor's occasional disdain for his relentlessly entrepreneurial relative, they'd take long walks together in Carlsbad.
He helped Bernays understand that you needed history, you needed sociology, and most importantly, you needed an understanding of psychology to know why people bought or voted or generally behaved the way they did, so that you could help reshape that behavior.
Larry Tye is author of The Father of Spin, which chronicles the development of Bernays' signature approach, which he called the engineering of consent. That's what America's first PR men did for the Woodrow Wilson administration when they embarked on a determined effort to sell an isolationist America on the war to end all wars, the costliest propaganda campaign up until then. Bernays was a junior member of that campaign, but 7 years later he was ready for another Washington hard sell, a president whose personality was so sour, said Alice Longworth Roosevelt, he looked as if he'd been weaned on a pickle.
I believe in the American Constitution. I favor the American system of individual enterprise.
Calvin Coolidge. Bernays used a cheap trick, glamour by association, to turn a cold fish into a hot dog by loading a crowd of stars and starlets onto a midnight train to Washington and then onto the White House, where they whooped it up with Cal and the wife. The headlines blazed with such scoops as, "Actors eat cake with the Coolidges."
I believe not only in advocating economy and public expenditure.
As the New York Times said in a headline the next day, "President almost laughs." Did that transform his image? No. Was it important, one little thing that helped him win re-election? Absolutely. Was it important in setting a stage for today's spinmeisters? Absolutely, lutely.
Bernays' most famous, or infamous, campaign to engineer consent involved the overthrow of a long-standing taboo, that against women smoking. In an interview shortly before his death in 1995, Bernays recalled that campaign.
One day, Mr. George Hill, president of the American Tobacco Company, called me in and said, "We're losing half of our market." I said, "Have I your permission to see a psychoanalyst?"
If he couldn't go directly to his uncle Sigmund Freud, he went to Freud's disciple, Dr. A.A. Brill.
I went to Dr. Brill and asked him what cigarettes meant to women, and he answered very quickly, "Cigarettes are torches of freedom to women. They want to smoke to dramatize man's taboo." And then he added, as an afterthought, "and they titillate the erogenous zones of the lips." it occurred to me that any young debutante who was aware of the times would be delighted to walk in the Easter parade from 34th Street to 57th, lighting torches of freedom to protest man's inhumanity to women by a taboo against smoking.
This incredible march was so delectable that every newspaper in America had a picture on their front page the next day of these women, very elegantly dressed, with a cigarette dangling from their hand or from their mouth.
Within 3 days, women were smoking in Union Square in San Francisco, Union Square in Denver, and on the Boston Common in solidarity with their sisters in New York.
Then, in 1920, women won their rights.
You've come a long way, baby.
Bernays was always quick to point out that all this happened 3 decades before the Surgeon General's report on smoking. No one really understood the dangers, except, as Larry Tye points out, Eddie Bernays did.
One of his jobs for American Tobacco was to take any reports indicating the risks of smoking. If he could, he was to cover them up, and if he couldn't, he was to make fun of them. At home, he told his 2 young daughters that if they found their mother's cigarettes in the house, they should, as he said, break them in half like brittle bones and flush them down the toilet.
In his book Propaganda, Bernays observed that our minds are molded largely by men we have never heard of. This invisible government, he said, is a logical requirement of democracy, which needs a consensus for things to run smoothly. And Bernays enthusiastically manipulated what he called this unseen mechanism of society. To sell books to a lukewarm public, he found celebrities to attest to the value of the printed word and then convinced architects to build bookshelves into their housing designs. To sell bacon to people inclined toward orange juice in a roll, he tapped doctors to pitch the health benefits of a heavy breakfast. And then in 1954, to safeguard the business interests of the United Fruit Company, he convinced the United States to make a revolution in Guatemala. Larry Tye.
Bernays took this government that was actually quite tepid in its socialism and helped shape them as a danger in the public eye.
Guatemala's new government was engaged in a reform program, turning over tracts of uncultivated acreage to 100,000 poor families. Some of that land belonged to the United Fruit Company. Bernays led the media on carefully orchestrated tours of Guatemala, emphasizing the danger it posed to the U.S. until American covert action helped to topple the Guatemalan government. The new rulers used terror to consolidate power through dislocation, torture, and murder. John Stauber is the editor of the newsletter PR Watch.
He was dressing up an overthrow of an elected government and the installation of a brutal military regime. So we would think our government policies were doing the good thing, the pro-democracy thing, in a country like Guatemala.
Since then, PR professionals often have enlisted in foreign wars. Hillen Knowlton, for example, was hired by the Kuwaiti government during the Persian Gulf War, arranging for hair-raising tales of Iraqis dumping babies out of incubators to be told on the floor of the Capitol, though the charge was never proved. Still, when the public does catch sight of the man behind the curtain, it reacts, like Dorothy did, with rage and contempt. Successful public relations professionals know that when skepticism reigns, honesty and openness are powerful persuaders. That's how Johnson & Johnson reacted when packages of tainted Tylenol were found in 1982. It opened its doors to reporters who closely followed the investigation.
The net result of their openness was that Tylenol came back like gangbusters, as opposed to what everybody had feared at the beginning, which is that Tylenol as a brand would be dead.
Marilyn Lorry spent most of her career in the top ranks of corporate PR at AT&T.
The public relations people associated with the Tylenol incident are heroes in the profession.
But almost by definition, public relations is an invisible enterprise. And Bernays' pioneering strategies, using celebrities and scientists, linking products with causes and status, still work their magic, still engineer our consent.
And they still do it invisibly. Here's another example. Listen.
Sure, it's packed with vitamin C, but orange juice has plenty more to offer. It can help protect your heart by raising your good cholesterol. And that's not all.
It's also rich in potassium, which reduces our risk for high blood pressure and for stroke.
That was a story about the health miracle of orange juice on WWLP-TV, Springfield, Massachusetts. But it wasn't a story discovered, written, and produced by WWLP. It was a VNR, a video news release, prepared by the Ketchum PR agency on behalf of its client, in this case, PepsiCo's Tropicana. Each year, thousands of such VNRs are distributed by corporations, government agencies, nonprofit organizations, and even members of Congress who have discovered it's easier to manage the news when you actually produce it yourself. Thus, the ever-growing deluge of expensively produced news-like video reports, crafted often by ex-journalists to look and sound like actual telejournalism.
It is not news. It is fake news.
John Stauber is executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy and author of Toxic Sludge is Good for You, a scathing lefty broadside against the public relations industry. He believes the use of VNRs amounts to systematic deception of viewers, both by the hidden interested parties behind them and by news organizations with impure motives themselves.
So if I'm a TV news director and I can fill most of the so-called 7 or 8 minute news hole on a local TV news program with provided footage that I get for free, I can save tens of thousands of dollars or more.
News directors don't like to talk about VNRs. The few who returned our calls said they seldom use the free material. But according to Nielsen Media Research, by 1994, 100% of TV stations were using them, and 80% were doing so at least several times a month. And today's digital watermarking of the footage proves nothing has changed. Larry Moskowitz is the founder and president of MediaLink, one of the world's largest producers and distributors of VNRs.
We've determined prima facie and scientifically and electronically that every television station in America with a newscast has used and probably uses regularly this material from corporations and organizations that we provide as VNRs or B-roll or other terminology we may use.
Not all VNRs run whole. Most often they are mined for a clip of background footage here, an interview fragment there. But producers estimate that as many as 1 in 3 appear uncut, unedited, and unexamined for balance or even basic accuracy. And why? Because they are there, tempting budget-battered news directors, and because they are free.
VNRs are enabling devices.
Former CBS correspondent Deborah Potter is director of the News Lab, the Washington, D.C. nonprofit dedicated to quality local television.
They allow newsrooms to do less of their own work without fear of running out of material before the end of the hour. It's a concern, and it ought to be a concern, frankly, for viewers if much of the material that they're starting to get on the news isn't news.
As long as there has been a press, there has been a symbiotic relationship between journalism and PR, and not necessarily an insidious one. Publicists and politicians looking to promote their agendas can serve those interests and the media's as well by calling attention to news or even fluff of interest to the public. It then becomes the media's job to establish the broader context and to separate the newsworthy wheat from the gratuitously promotional chaff, and to be clear about the source of PR-furnished material. For instance, the Tropicana excerpt you heard at the top of this piece we found in a documentary based on John Stauber's book, Deborah Potter.
I feel very strongly that if stations are going to use VNR material, they need to tell where it came from. It makes a difference if the whaling video you're using came from Greenpeace or from the Coalition to Support Whaling.
Barbara Cochran, president of the Radio and Television News Directors Association, says she believes most stations and networks do routinely identify the source of outside video, as per the ethical guidelines of her organization. But those within the VNR industry roll their eyes at that assertion. Doug Simon of VNR producer D.S. Simon Productions says disclosure is the exception, not the rule.
From what we see, there's a very small percentage, perhaps less than 5%, that actually is identified what the source of the video is.
That makes him uneasy, but VNR producers can't do such disclosure themselves. Each station uses a different on-screen typeface to identify video, so the onus is on those airing the material. And dependent as they are on the illusion of a far-flung news-gathering operation with tentacles throughout the community and beyond, there's little motivation to do so.
Can I say that local television stations have been lax? Yeah.
MediaLink's Moskowitz acknowledges that stations are less than scrupulous about identifying the source of the footage he supplies. He does not believe, however, that the sin is particularly grave, at least compared to other forms of journalism.
There is more unexpurgated, unedited, and unredacted press information that shows up in the average daily newspaper in America, and certainly in the average weekly newspaper, probably by a 5-to-1 factor over the PR material that shows up in television. So you might be going after the wrong goat here.
The two wrongs make a right argument isn't the only one in favor of the video news release. Candace White, marketing professor at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville and co-author of a 2001 study about VNRs, says the same self-interest that encourages news directors to use VNRs dictates that the material is used responsibly.
See, I trust news producers to be able to weed out true news value. I give them credit for being able to recognize blatant sales pitches. Our study found that the corporate videos were used the least, and the ones about health and safety were used the most.
But it's not necessarily the blatant sales pitches that are so dangerous. It is the subtle sales pitches. And the implication of independent journalistic approval conferred on a company or organization and its point of view, which is why her study's co-author, journalism professor Mark Harmon, sees VNRs as, quote, insidious devices by corporate America to control the American agenda. Nor is the problem restricted to the local news. Not only do major networks use VNR footage, at least one, CBS, has a division which produces and distributes them. This gets back to the disdain and fear voiced by author and consumer advocate John Stauber.
All public relations is not sinister or evil or bad. But I think the important thing to understand is that, indeed, all public relations is propaganda.
So whether it's images of a NASA spacewalk or a self-congratulatory soundbite from your congressman or swell health news about delicious calcium-fortified Tropicana orange juice, the message for TV news consumption is as ever. Let the viewer beware. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Megan Ryan and Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Natasha Kurganker. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bydell Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.